nombre es Alberto y somos de El Salvador. Estamos aquí en los Estados Unidos.
My name is Alberto, and we're from El Salvador. We've been here in the U.S. since September 2015, fleeing from violence.
In 2015, Alberto and his 7-year-old son attempted to come to the United States. Alberto's wife and daughter would try to follow later.
Well, honestly, in El Salvador, it's really difficult with the gangs. If one pays the rent they demand, one can live for a certain amount of time. But honestly, it's not stable. But if someone does not have a way to give them the money they demand, they are... They kill them.
They didn't have papers, but they tried to cross the border anyway. Then they were apprehended by immigration agents.
They put us adults in one place and the youngest in another place. And they don't let you see them. They just tell you they're going to be okay.
Agents put Alberto in one cell and his son in another.
Yes, it was only for one night, but it was really hard not knowing. What are they going to do with my son, or what are they going to do with me? Many things go through your mind.
It was one night that Alberto cannot forget.
When someone enters the place, the one known as the icebox, there isn't a place for one to lay down. You have to lay down on the floor. And for a person, they only give you They only give you a plastic, but that doesn't protect you from the cold at all. If I'm in that situation, sleeping like that in that moment, well, I was thinking, what could be happening to my child?
Now, we have to be clear. This was in 2015, under the Obama administration. At the time, the official policy for Customs and Border Patrol was explicitly not to separate parents from their children, especially for mothers and their children. But CBP officials could use discretion. We contacted a former senior immigration official in the Obama administration, and he told us, quote, "When a family is apprehended at the border, it is indeed the case that the kids are placed in a location with other kids while the parent is initially screened. This is because when the Border Patrol first apprehends a group of many people, it is not safe to have grown men in cells with little kids." He added that in these situations, the parent and the child were in the same facility even when separated, which is different than what's happening under Trump. Today, parents are being prosecuted and their child is being taken to an entirely different facility. But we're telling you Alberto's story so we can understand what it feels like to seek asylum in the United States and be separated from your child, even for one night. And Alberto said agents did not explain where they would put his child. They only told him he would be safe.
Yes, even though it was one night, it's really hard. Being in that moment, and I don't wish that on anyone for that to happen. So yeah, it's really hard. When we were finally together, he hugged me and cried. So imagine, what could have gone on in his little mind? Being so young and being separated that night, it's really hard.
Today, Alberto and his family are living in the United States and seeking asylum. Their case is pending. But even now, his son is scared to be too far apart.
He doesn't like being in that moment again, like that, separated from his mom, from me, his sister. He says so. He doesn't want to live that again.
Now, under the Trump administration, there is a zero-tolerance policy at the border. The administration says migrants who try to cross illegally will be apprehended, charged with a crime, and separated from their children for an unknown amount of time. There have been media reports of ICE agents misleading parents, telling them their kids are just being taken away for questioning, or in one instance, just being taken for a bath, with parents learning hours later that their children are not coming back. I'm Tanzina Vega, and today on The Takeaway, the trauma of family separation and its long-term impact on kids. It's hard to know exactly how many families are being separated through President Trump's zero-tolerance policy. A U.S. Customs and Border Protection official testified last month to Congress that 658 children were separated from 638 parents between May 6th and May 19th. That's just a two-week period. In order to house the increasing number of migrant children, the Trump administration just announced it is looking to build tent cities at military posts in Texas.
The impact is harmful on children.
That's Dr. Colleen A. Kraft, and she's the president of the American Academy of Pediatrics. On behalf of that organization, she's asked the Department of Homeland Security to stop removing children from their parents for the sake of their mental and physical health. She recently visited a detention center that held children who had been separated from their parents.
What I visited was a shelter that was staffed by the Office for Refugee Resettlement. And when I went in there, the first room I went into was the toddler room. And in the toddler room, there were several children who were very young, anywhere between 18 months and 3 years of age. And there was one little girl who was just crying and sobbing and couldn't be consoled on one of the mats in the center. The staff were by her, but they weren't allowed to hold her or comfort her. So she was just crying and wailing. Her little arms and legs were just pounding, and she was inconsolable. And we all knew why. We knew that she had been taken from her mother, and she wanted her mother.
So we just heard the story of one migrant, Alberto, and he and his son were separated for just a day. But we know that this is occurring in much more aggressive ways and for much longer periods of time today. What is the impact of even a short separation?
The impact is harmful on children. And I can best explain this in the patterns of what we know happen to the brain with different types of stress. This has actually been something scientifically measured, the response of the body and the brain to different stressors. So there's a pattern that happens in young children, in all of us. It's called positive stress. Positive stress is brief and self-limited examples of stressful times that we all experience. So for a young child, this might be like a temper tantrum. So someone has said no, and they start crying. And what happens in their body and their brain is that their inflammatory markers, their fight or flight hormones rise. And then in the presence of an adult who can be caring and comforting, they fall and they're redirected. And the brain actually becomes resilient from that type of stress interaction. And we know that only happens in the presence of a loving and caring adult for a young child. Separation of parents and children results in something that we call toxic stress, where those same chemicals, those fight or flight hormones, the inflammatory markers, the cortisol remain high in these children. And without that parent to help buffer that reaction, these chemicals go on to destroy the architecture of that child's developing brain. They destroy the synapses that occur that result in the ability for that child to love, to learn, to develop. So separation, even for a short time, is something that's toxic to a child's developing brain.
And we're talking about emotional well-being. What about physical consequences to this?
So for young children, if they're exposed to toxic stress, the first thing that happens is disruption in their child development. So when we see young children who are separated from parents and who are not given that adult to be reassuring and loving, they go on initially to not develop their speech and language and not develop their gross motor skills and to have developmental delays. And some may even seem like they are on the autism spectrum. But later on, what this happens is it develops the consequences of what we call our adverse childhood experiences. And this stress goes on to develop heart disease, obesity, cancer, rheumatoid arthritis. So we know that there are terrible health consequences for these children as a result of this toxic stress.
Also, more broadly, the overall climate in the United States has rhetoric right now that I actually reported on this about a year ago about how children of color, Black children, Latino children, Muslim children, are increasingly feeling like many people in this country are hostile towards them as a whole. Are there broader implications to this type of toxic stress?
There are absolutely broader implications to this type of toxic stress. What happens is that overall, this toxic stress really robs these children of the ability to love and to learn and to do well in school and to graduate from high school and to go on to college and to be successful. And later on in life, it robs them of their capacity to be healthy, grown adults.
Now let's talk about what can be done. Are there specific ages that children are more susceptible to this type of stress?
Children are most susceptible to toxic stress at very young ages. So we're talking the 0 to 3-year-olds, because that's when their brain is building. That's when the synapses are coming together. And in the brain, there are billions of these synapses, these connections that happen in the 0 to 3 years. And as they get older, these synapses are pruned away. So in the 0 to 3 age group, if a child is exposed to love, these synapses for learning, for language, for love become very strong. And what gets pruned away later on are the bad experiences, the upset, the fear, the anxiety. In children who grow up with toxic stress, they never make those connections, and what stays and remains are anxiety, our fear, our other difficulties that go on to really rob that child of the ability to grow into a healthy adult.
And are there any solutions or any treatments that children who have already experienced this type of trauma should be aware of, or their parents should be aware of?
We know that children that have experienced this type of trauma, and many of them are in our foster care system, respond well to something called trauma-focused cognitive behavioral therapy or other therapies that really focus on the trauma that this child has experienced. And there are things that we can do for these kids, but it's much easier to build a strong child than to repair a child who's had this type of damage.
Dr. Colleen Kraft is president of the American Academy of Pediatrics. Thanks so much for being here, doctor.
Thank you.
Last fall, 16 wildfires tore across Northern California. 44 people died, and thousands of homes and other buildings were either damaged or destroyed. And the big question back in October was, what caused the fires, and could they have been prevented? California State Fire Agency has released the cause for 12 of the wildfires in the North Bay. And there's a common thread. In all but one, Cal Fire named Pacific Gas and Electric, the biggest utility in California, as a culprit. The news confirms what KQED reporters heard in 911 calls as they listened to the night that the fire started.
What's on fire?
A transformer blew, a PG&E transformer, and it lit up our whole window.
Is our house on fire? What's on fire?
PG&E emergency dispatch.
Hi, I need this Redcom. I need you expedited for a wires down that started a structure fire.
Is there anyone trapped in that location?
Nope. Fire's on scene. I have to go. Bye-bye.
Marisa Lagos is a political reporter for KQED, and she's part of the team that's been investigating the North Bay fires. Marisa, thanks for coming back.
Thanks for having me.
So this is pretty big news. What have we learned about the causes of the North Bay fire so far?
Well, in all, we've heard about 12 fires, actually 16 across Northern California, but 12 within the region we're talking about. And in basically every case, they've said that it is PG&E lines. Now, that doesn't mean necessarily that the utility will be held completely liable in all those cases. They're saying that in 8 of those cases that they're referring them to prosecutors because they believe that PG&E may not have followed all the state laws and regulations around keeping the maintenance going around those lines, clearing brush and trees, that sort of thing.
Had this been a concern before these fires started? What was it? Is it that they're not taking care of the lines? Is that these lines are susceptible to fires no matter what? Give us a sense of what their culpability could be in this.
Well, this is not the first time this has happened. There was actually a deadly fire up in Butte County in the foothills several years ago that also killed somebody for similar reasons. And you might remember the 2010 San Bruno blast where a gas line owned by PG&E blew up a neighborhood in the Bay Area and killed 8 people. So I do think that there have been questions for years about PG&E's safety practices around upkeep of, you know, its equipment. In the San Bruno case, for example, they were actually found by regulators and in court to have basically taken money that they said they were using on safety tests and upgrades and to sort of have rerouted that to shareholders. We don't know if that's the case here. And I think it's important to note that there were extraordinary conditions the night of these fires, hot, dry winds that fueled these blazes once they broke out. But I think that the question, yeah, now becomes, did they make sure there was enough feet of clearance around power lines in areas where there are trees and brush? Did they, you know, upgrade those lines and use the best technology possible? And then another thing we reported on is this issue of whether or not, and in this case they didn't, but they should have been powering down lines once, you know, explosions occurred or lines broke, because once you, you know, repower those lines, they can start sparking and actually start new fires once again. And that's a practice that PG&E and state fire investigators told us they hadn't done in the northern part of the state in the past. They hadn't ordered PG&E to power down lines, but that practice is now changing.
How liable is PG&E in these findings? I mean, you mentioned earlier that they might not face criminal charges. What is the likelihood that they could?
So on the criminal side, that's really going to be up to prosecutors in each of these counties. We now have, you know, 9 of these cases in the wine country area that have been referred to prosecutors. But there's a sort of host of other ways that PG&E could be found liable and ordered by courts or the state to pay fines or damages. So we have over 150 lawsuits pending by victims, including entire counties and cities affected. The state regulators who oversee gas and electric will investigate this. They already are. And in the case of San Bruno, for example, they fined PG&E $1.6 billion. So there's a lot of sort of outstanding potential questions around liability. And at the same time, the utility has been out there very vocal recently about the fact that they want to see state law changed so that they're not on the hook for as much of this. And in some cases, so that utilities can pass off some of these costs to ratepayers instead of shareholders. So, you know, I think this is one of those things that it will drag on for years. We may not know for several years really the full extent of financial. And then, of course, there's, you know, in the criminal issue, they could be prosecuted for felonies.
Well, and I mean, the question, there's so much damage. We had damage to property. There was loss of life in these fires. How are folks in the area reacting to this news? Does it sort of confirm what they had suspected all along for the most part?
I think so. And I think there's a lot of frustration, obviously, about everyone's losses. And I think when you go through that kind of trauma, it, you know, things can re-trigger you and it's very emotional and difficult. And then I think a lot of people are very angry about the fact that, you know, the posture PG&E is taking. They actually filed claims against some of these cities and counties recently, which are precursors to lawsuits, essentially saying, well, this could be the county's fault for not doing, you know, their side of things when it came to letting people build in certain areas or upkeep of other infrastructure. So it's a pretty contentious situation. And again, I think we're going to continue to see this play out in court dozens and dozens of times over.
Now, has PG&E responded directly to this news? Have you had a chance to talk to them yourself?
They have declined most all interviews, but they did put out a statement when these reports were issued last week. They say that they've followed the law and regulations. They say that climate change and drought have really changed the dynamic in California, and that they really do see that this is a bigger problem than just their equipment that the state needs to tackle. And I should note that our governor, Jerry Brown, has indicated, not super directly, but issued some statements where he seems to be backing them up about that new normal and the need to at least look at whether state liability laws need to be updated, given, you know, how destructive some of these fires have become in recent years.
Marisa Lagos is a political reporter for KQED. Thanks so much, Marisa.
Thanks, Tanzina.
Five states held primaries on Tuesday, and that brings the total number of states that have held their 2018 primaries so far to 21. And if last night was any indication, it might have shown us that the GOP is officially becoming the party of Trump. We turn now to Politico's Elena Schneider to understand the primary results. Hi, Elena.
Hi, thanks for having me.
No worries. So last night we had some amazing results in South Carolina and Virginia. Let's start with Virginia, where Corey Stewart, who's a pretty fringe candidate, won the party's nomination. And I want to play you a clip from his victory party last night.
And finally, folks, Virginia can choose to continue to let criminal illegal aliens like MS-13... And by the way, they are animals. They're animals.
Elena, that was Corey Stewart. Tell us why, beyond that comment, why he's considered so controversial.
Well, he's a candidate who ran for governor of the Republican primary in 2017 and gained a lot of headlines for his support of Confederate flags. And is somebody who just often says really sharp things, as you noted, on immigration, abortion rights, and removal of Confederate monuments. So this is somebody who very much represents a wing of the Republican Party that often can align itself with the alt-right, and somebody who they see as a champion. And that's really problematic for Republicans in Virginia who need to win these suburban districts outside of Washington, outside of Richmond, to hold on to their House districts there. And the concern amongst Republicans, more mainstream Republicans in the state, is that somebody like Corey Stewart's really going to depress turnout there. And in fact, Virginia's former Lieutenant Governor Bill Bowling tweeted last night that he's, quote, extremely disappointed that Stewart could win. And he said, every time I think things can't get any worse, they do, and there is no end in sight. That's really the feeling amongst mainstream Republicans of Virginia today.
So then what are mainstream Republicans doing if the narrative today is that essentially if you're anti-Trump, and we'll talk a little bit about other races that are showing that you may not win?
So, look, this is the tension. You're putting your finger right on the tension of what Republicans, elected officials, are dealing with every day, which is cross Trump and things like what happened to Mark Sanford down in South Carolina, who lost his primary bid, becoming the second member to be booted from Congress in 2018 because he was a vocal critic, or you align yourself with him and you get support from the base. But again, this is sort of a mixed bag of how Trump sort of lines up in these sorts of things. I mean, obviously, Mark Sanford was somebody who was a critic of the president, a critic of the way that he, his support for Confederate monuments. But so was Scott Taylor in Virginia. He's another Republican member. And Scott Taylor, granted, didn't have nearly as well-funded of an opponent, but he was able to slide to re-election. So sometimes, maybe if you don't draw the attention of Trump with a tweet like Mark Sanford did, then or a more active campaign against you, then you can sort of slide by. But look, it's still very precarious waters for Republicans right now in primaries.
And we're going to get back to South Carolina in a second, but I just want to go back to Stewart because he's going to face off against Senator Tim Kaine. Now, as we know, Kaine was Hillary Clinton's vice presidential pick. Do you suspect that that will have any impact on the results going forward?
Tim Kaine was already a favorite to win the Senate election in 2018, and now it seems almost impossible for him to lose at this point. So Tim Kaine certainly got the candidate who is who makes it easier for him in November, and it was already, you know, Virginia is already trending based on the 2017 results there, and the governor's race and the legislative races is trending bluer, and it was already looking pretty safe for Kaine, and it is even safer today.
So back in South Carolina, we have the incumbent Republican Governor Henry McMaster, who's running for his first full term. And as our listeners may remember, he's the one who replaced Nikki Haley when she joined the Trump administration. So McMaster has the president's backing. And from what we understand, this race is headed to a runoff.
That's correct. So nobody was able to clear the 50% threshold, which is required in South Carolina to avoid a runoff. So he'll face John Warren, another Republican, in a runoff later in June. And again, this is evidence of sort of where Trump support can sometimes be a mixed bag, where being against him is often fatal, but being for him or being his endorsed candidate isn't necessarily a guarantee that you're going to walk away with a clean win. So McMaster was one of the earliest supporters of Donald Trump, came out in January of 2016 in support of him. And Trump has answered that support and, you know, and that loyalty by being right there behind him, you know, endorsing him back in October of 2017. But again, McMaster wasn't able to clear that threshold, and it makes it clear that, you know, Trump support is important, but it's not everything.
Well, and wondering if these are indications of pro-Trump candidates are able to get elected now, but are they electable in a general election?
Well, look, we're still talking about South Carolina. This is still a very red state. It's not a place like Georgia in which Democrats feel like the demographics are turning in their favor. At the end of the day, it's likely that Governor McMaster, if he makes it through his primary, will be able to win re-election. But then, you know, look, James Smith, who is the Democrat who was elected last night, avoided a runoff in his race, is somebody who has gotten a lot of support. He's been backed by Jim Clyburn and a former resident. Vice President Joe Biden. He's somebody who's going to put up a stiff fight, but it's still South Carolina at the end of the day.
Shifting gears up to Maine, we talked about this on the program yesterday about how elections in Maine were going to be conducted through something known as ranked choice voting, and that ranked choice voting in itself was also going to be voted on. So lots happening in Maine. Can you give us a quick update on that?
So in Maine, we're still waiting for a lot of results because they're dealing with this new system for the first time. And whether or not that system remains in place is still uncertain at this point.
Elena Schneider is a campaign political reporter for Politico. Elena, always great to have you on The Takeaway. Thank you.
Thanks so much for having me.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with WGBH Radio in Boston.
In 2007, Coloradan Miguel Peña Rodriguez was convicted of misdemeanors related to groping two teenage girls. Later, he learned that a juror in the case had allegedly said that Peña Rodriguez was guilty because he was Mexican, saying that Mexican men, quote, had a bravado that caused them to believe they could do whatever they wanted with women. So in 2017, the Supreme Court sent the case of Miguel Peña Rodriguez back down to the lower courts. And that case, along with some other recent decisions, established a precedent for how courts rule in cases where jurors display racial bias. But what about demonstrations of a juror's bias around someone's sexual orientation? Does the same precedent hold? This Thursday, the Supreme Court will decide whether to take on a case that could answer that question. Maurice Shema is here to explain. He's a staff writer at the Marshall Project and author of this week's Case in Point. Maurice, welcome back to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So this is a case that goes back to 1993. Charles Rimes was sentenced to death for fatally stabbing a man. Tell us a little bit more about the facts surrounding the murder.
Sure. So Charles Rimes in 1992 went to rob a donut store in Rapid City, South Dakota, and there was an employee there named Donovan Schaefer, and Rimes stabbed him as he stole money from the shop. The jury then found him guilty the next year, and they had this question of whether to sentence him to death or give him life in prison. And when it came time in the jury room to decide what to do next, they sent out a list of questions to the judge saying, you know, will he have a cellmate? Will he be able to create a group of admirers in the prison? Will he be able to brag about his crime to younger prisoners? There were these sort of weird implications around sexuality, but they were very subtle and very under the surface. And then a couple of decades later, his lawyers went back and found these jurors and discovered that in the jury room, there had been some discussion of the fact that Mr. Rines is gay, and that there was an idea that if he were sentenced to life in prison, that he would like it because he's a man and would be in a male prison, which is sort of shocking on its face.
Well, you were able to speak to a juror, Frances Cerso-Simo, and we're going to play a clip from a conversation with her.
He had made the statement, well, if they have all these privileges and if he's gay, it might not be so bad for him. As I recall, the murmur from many of the jurors in the room was like, what? Meaning, really? He immediately said that that was a stupid thing to say. We moved on with our discussion. I firmly believe Charles Rines being gay had no bearing on the unanimous decision for the death penalty that he was given.
Murray says what she's saying is what Frances is saying. They're consistent with what the other members of the jury told you.
That's kind of the problem, that we're talking about what happened in a jury room 25 years ago, and you have 12 people with 12 different memories. So I spoke to three jurors. Frances remembered this one comment. Another juror didn't remember the comment at all. Another juror, I reached his wife, and he now has dementia, and so he doesn't remember what happened in the jury room. If you look at the court documents that were filed by investigators for the defense, they found that a handful of jurors, more than just Frances, another two, said explicitly, we sentenced him to death in part because we didn't think he should be able to spend the rest of his life in a prison with men. They were somewhat explicit about it. Then, a few years after that, the state sends out its own investigator who finds a bunch of jurors, some of whom slam the door on them, some of them say, I'm tired of being harassed, but then some of whom say, no, that never happened. We solely based our decision on the fact that the crime was very brutal. He stabbed this man, I think, in the neck. He went and ate an order of French fries afterwards. It was a very, very gruesome crime, and the crime alone was the reason that we sentenced him to death. Frances openly said there was this passing comment that was made. Some other jurors said, I just don't remember that. Maybe it happened. Again, we're talking about 25 years later. And that really gets into how tough these cases can be when you talk about sort of re-examining what jurors thought and felt and said to each other when they weren't recorded and memories are fuzzy and decades pass.
And for those of our listeners who haven't been in a jury room or who haven't served on a jury, I mean, jurors are repeatedly told to stick to the facts of the case, not to get emotional about these decisions. How could this note have made its way so many years ago without sort of raising any red flags then?
Well, I think it's because the questions in that note are pretty subtle. I mean, in the sense that, you know, on first read, I'm not sure that if I saw, you know, a note that said, will he have a cellmate? Could he create a group of admirers? That, I mean, could just signal, you know, we're concerned that life in prison wouldn't be fully punitive enough for this man. You know, if the judge had said, come back and said, no, he's going to be in his cell 24 hours a day, it's going to be very brutal. Maybe the jurors would have said, oh, well, then a life sentence is okay. So they wanted some context there.
What I find stunning about this is that there are levels of punitive that apparently the jury, so far from what I'm hearing, is deciding on. Like it's not enough to lock somebody up for life, right? That we need to take it another step further.
Right. And I mean, you know, jurors are always told to stick to the facts of a case. But in a death penalty context, they've already found someone guilty. And this is a separate conversation about the best punishment. And it's sort of hard to imagine how that couldn't become related to emotion, right? Because the death penalty is such a extreme sanction for a crime. Life in prison is also an extreme sanction. So you can imagine that people are, and I've interviewed jurors in many other cases as well, you know, there's this conversation that happens about, you know, this person did this really terrible thing, what is appropriate for them? And emotion gets into that. It's sort of inevitable, I think.
Now, we mentioned the Supreme Court has actually ruled on racial bias in the jury room and the limits of that. How could those rulings influence what we're expected to see when SCOTUS takes this case up later this week?
So later this week, they're going to decide whether to take this case on. They could decide not to take it, but wait for it to kind of percolate in the lower courts more. They could wait for it to come back to them again. But really the central question here is that, you know, for many, many decades, it was a kind of article of faith. It was a part of our law that what happens in the jury room sort of stays in the jury room, that what jurors thought and felt and said to each other isn't something you can really unpack on appeal and overturn a sentence on. That changed once they started looking at these racial bias cases. They said, that can't fly. And so now the question is, well, does sexual orientation count in the same way? And if it does count, what needs to happen for something to rise to that level, right? Do the jurors have to say something explicit? You know, they all said in when they were originally sort of selected for the jury that they could take into account the fact that he was gay and they wouldn't be biased about it. Are you challenging them and saying that they were lying, right? So there's all these questions that suddenly come up if you sort of open the box on what happens in the jury room in terms of sexual orientation. I could also imagine that a skeptic might come and say to the court, well, it's a slippery slope. If you open it up to sexual orientation, what about ageism? What about gender? What about, and you could just see that list of whataboutes could grow. Charles Rines's lawyers say, no, this is pretty simple. Sexual orientation and race are both these sort of special protected categories. We have entire sort of bodies of jurisprudence that protect these classes of people. And so, you know, this neatly fits within that, and we don't have to sort of open up the box in a really big way. But I think that that's kind of the dynamic that we should expect if this case were to be taken up and argued.
Maurice Shema is a staff writer at the Marshall Project. Thanks for being with us, Maurice.
Thank you.
And that's our show for today. But for those of you following the saga of hashtag NPR raccoon, a moment of high anxiety for some of us and bonding for others, the raccoon who scaled a skyscraper and became a social media sensation overnight, the latest reports are he survived. More on this story as it develops. You can call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or send us a tweet at The Takeaway. Thanks so much for being with me today. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway. See you Thursday.
Got a comment for the show? Hit us up on our Facebook page, tweet us at The Takeaway, or leave us a voicemail at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Your ideas and takes are a huge part of who we are. Let us know what you're thinking about. This is The Takeaway.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing. Or
politics.
Country music.
Hockey.
Sex. Of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.